Hi, I'm Professor Jackson. You just heard that. Sorry, I might have a little bit of the running adrenaline in my head from having sort of run over to my office to pick up my iPod. Not that I necessarily need the iPod for what I want to talk to you about tonight, but it is sort of one of the things that I'm kind of known for is that I've been podcasting for a number of years. And if you don't know what podcasting is, your kids do. So ask them. And if they do ask you, yes, in fact, this will be downloadable through that wonder of technology, the iTunes Music Store. If anybody's really interested in hearing what I have to say about Western civilization, which is what I actually want to talk to you about tonight, because it is the subject of the book that wasn't just published this year, it actually literally finished rolling off of the presses 1 week ago today. So they just finished it, and then they shut down for the 4th of July, and then they mailed them all to me. So it just got published. You are actually the first audience to hear what this book is about, besides the students I've been inflicting it on for the last 10 years. So you are the first, right? You are the very first audience. And I don't want to, it's a reasonably long book, it's a couple hundred pages long, so I don't want to go through the entire book with you by any stretch of the imagination. Instead, what I want to do is I want to just hit a couple of the high points of sort of what it is that I've been working on, and then because this is a session in which we want to talk a little bit about teaching at AU and meet the real live faculty member, I'll talk a little bit about how it may sort of play into some of the sorts of things that, how to phrase this. That I might be doing to your kids if you let me have them? No. That they will be exposed to if they are in any of my classes or in the classes of some of my colleagues. But let's talk a little bit here. I want to talk a little bit about Western civilization. Again, that's sort of what the book is about. And Western civilization has kind of been in the news a lot lately. We've been hearing more about the West, and particularly about the non-West. Actually, people have done some interesting statistical studies of how often words like West and Western civilization get used, and it's certainly on the upswing lately. We're hearing much more about the West and the West being under threat and those sorts of things. Why is this happening? Well, part of it, of course, is just post-September 11th. There's a lot of talk about the Western world being under threat from the non-Western world, because whenever you talk about the West, it always seems that it's inevitably coupled with the rest, you know, everybody who's not the West, and the sorts of things that the not West would like to do to the West. I mean, that's the usual way that this comes out in the popular discourse. I'm going to use the most neutral term I can find, situation in Iraq, has provoked a lot of interesting discussions about the West, about the Western powers, about Western values and Western norms being under threat or being defended. So you're hearing a lot more about these things lately. And often you will hear it phrased something like this, right? You'll hear a question, you know, why do they hate us? And the they is understood to be the non-West, and the us is understood to be part of this thing called the West, or Western civilization. And there's something kind of odd about this language, as I want to suggest, and sort of what the book is about the oddness of this language. But before I talk about that, I want to mention someone that, you know, most people in my profession you've never heard of before, right? Most people who are professional scholars of international relations, see, what we do, we go to conferences and we talk to big crowds at our conferences are, you know, 10 people, six of whom are grad students, three of whom are your own grad students, big popular books within IR, biggest best-selling book in international relations proper, international relations, the scholarly discipline over the last few years, book called Social Theory of International Politics by Alexander Wendt, sold 5,000 copies. Huge, massive, massive bestseller, right? Big impact. Because the whole field of international relations scholarship is, 10,000 people. You're not talking about a huge field. So 5,000 of them buying the book is a big deal. But one of the people who you may have actually heard of in my line of work is this guy named Sam Huntington. Anybody heard of Sam Huntington? Samuel Huntington, The Clash of Civilizations? He's one of the people, very few people within my profession, who get their book put on the stands at the airport. You know, when you're trying to figure out, like, which novel to take with you on the plane, and then there's, like, the other book next to it. It's like, oh, look, The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. So he got the paperback contract and everything. And so lots of people sort of read this, or at least lots of people saw this. And Huntington's basic argument is there are essential differences between the West and other civilizations in the world, and the West needs to be careful not to go out and impose its values on all those non-Western parts of the world, because all those non-Western people who are really not like us aren't going to like that very much. So what we should do is we should stick to our own, and we should let them stay to their own. So he had this recipe for, what did he call it, multiculturalism abroad and monoculturalism at home, which seemed to have a lot to do with English-only legislation in schools somehow. That was kind of his punchline. But he was really important with propelling this kind of notion. a rebirth of this notion of Western civilization in popular polite discourse. And I always found this to be kind of puzzling. And I find it to be kind of puzzling because if we think about this analytically, which is the way that I tend to think about these things because I am, after all, a scholar of international relations, the thing that interests me is this language of Western civilization, this way of talking about things, this piece of political rhetoric, if you will, that Western civilization represents. And what I tend to do typographically when I'm talking about not the thing, but like the story about the thing, I put it in single quotation marks. So when I say that, that means the rhetoric of Western civilization, the idea of Western civilization. And there's something kind of odd about this. I mean, one of the things that I find really odd about this when we think about IR is international relations is divided up into a bunch of sovereign territorial states. This is what, if your students take introductory IR, or if you had introductory IR many years ago at college, or yesterday at college for some of you, then this will you'll learn about states and anarchy and states recognizing each other and so on and so forth. You don't hear about civilizations. You hear about states. And the weird thing about civilizations is, civilizations are bigger than states. So if you've got an international system, it's supposed to be all divided up with sovereign territorial states. And think about it. Who belongs to the UN? States. Who belongs to WTO? States. Where does the West belong? Right? Where's the civilizations organization? There really isn't one. Right? The whole thing is actually divided up into sovereign states. But we have this weird notion of civilization, which appears to be bigger than a state and still floating around. So there's something kind of odd about that. There's also something kind of odd about Western civilization in that it's one of those things that you say and everybody kind of nods their heads. Oh yeah, the West, sure, you know, Western values, sure. It's like Judeo-Christian values, everybody's like, until you start asking them exactly what they mean. And then you discover that people don't actually agree on the specifics. Everybody agrees in general. Everybody agrees in general that there's a thing called the West and we're all part of it and there's sort of Western values and such. But then you start asking people to list Western values. If I did it in this room, you know, we have however many different answers there are people in the room. Everybody disagrees on the specifics. So how can something that we all disagree about still command this vague agreement and still actually get people to do things? How is this still a useful piece of political rhetoric if we all disagree on the specifics? The other thing I found really odd, especially when you start doing a historical talk or historical study of this particular language of Western civilization, is that Western civilization never shows up in a sentence that goes something like this. And Western civilization, which is hale, hearty, and at peace. Right? It always shows up as Western civilization is declining, ending, under threat, being invaded, eroding, falling apart, collapsing. It's this very end-time kind of rhetoric that's always associated with it. Something kind of odd about a concept like that. Why would there be a concept that only seems to get invoked when people feel like it's under threat? Right? Why wouldn't it be invoked at other times? Why is it mostly invoked in these moments of crisis? So there's something kind of puzzling about that. And because I'm an academic, I said, oh, there's something puzzling about this. Why don't I write a book about it? Why don't I read about this a lot and then write a book about it? Because that's what we do. And what I have would like to tell you tonight a little bit is I want to give you three different versions here. I want to give you sort of three stories about this particular language of Western civilization. One of the stories I want to tell you is a theoretical story, which is a story where I'm going to have to give you a very quick introduction to international relations lesson. It'll only take about 30 seconds, don't worry. The next story I want to tell you, which is in some ways the more interesting story, is an empirical story. Where did this notion come from and what does it do? Right? What is the history of this notion of Western civilization, very briefly. And then the third thing I want to tell you is kind of a moral story or an ethical story. Given this history that I want to briefly sketch, what does that mean about the use of this particular language? What does this mean about the notion of Western civilization? How should we be reacting to this or using it in the future? So, story number one, the very quick theoretical story. Now, like I said, in order to do this, I have to give you a real quick IR lesson. And one of the things that is important about international relations is the major, for many years, the only school of theoretical analysis in IR, something called realism. And realism was the basic idea that states were interested in their military and physical security, the only thing they're interested in, and everything states do can be reduced to their military and the relative military balance between them and other states. This was IR theory from like the 1940s on up through about the 1970s and 80s. That was pretty much the dominant approach within the field. All about military and physical security. You used to get these debates at conferences where people would go, how do you rate a tank against a plane? Is a tank worth two-thirds of a plane? Is a tank worth three-quarters of a plane? How do we sort of calculate that? That was what people were discussing. Low about the mid-1980s, coincidentally, the same gentleman I mentioned before who had the best-selling book in international relations for the last several years, this guy named Alexander Wendt, came up with a different IR theory, which he called constructivism. And constructivism, by the way, by showing you these things, I'm not showing you the dumbed-down version of these two theories. I'm showing you actually what these two theories are. IR is not physics. This is not we have to express everything in mathematical terms so that we can come up with something that sort of looks really different. This is people write in like plain language within IR. And so he came up with this approach, which was called constructivism. It was based on the basic simple intuition that states tend not to be actual beings. They tend to actually have people who represent them. And people, when people react to things, they do not tend to just react to physical things. They react to meanings. They react to the way in which something is made meaningful. And the example that went liked a lot was, we are more worried about two North Korean nuclear weapons that might not actually fire than we are about thousands of British nuclear weapons that we know will fire and are much more accurate and are much more likely to hit us if they were ever used. Why are we not worried about the British nuclear weapons, but we're worried about the North Koreans? Wentz said, it's because of the story that we tell. They mean different things. The British nuclear weapons mean, hey, increased peace and security for our guys. The North Korean nuclear weapons mean, ooh, crazy person must take care of that somehow. Right? This helps to explain a number of weird anomalies in IR, like why the United States cares about Cuba so much. I mean, come on. Cuba? What, they're going to invade us? I mean, why are we so concerned about Cuba? Well, it's because of this Cold War story about the United States being opposed to communism and Cuba being the last bastion of Cold War communism. So, of course, the United States is not going to start cooperating with it all of a sudden, right? But it's because of the meaning, because of the story. One of the things that I argue in my book, and this is minor, but again, there is a theoretical story to tell about the West, is that the constructivists are right and the realists are wrong, that the way world politics works is actually much more about stories and meaning than it is about raw physical objects. I'll just give you two quick examples which figure into the book. Number one is the Cold War, which for many years everybody thought the Cold War was just about the United States having lots of nuclear weapons and the Soviet Union having lots of nuclear weapons and them pointing them at each other, and that was the Cold War. That turns out not to be the case. You know how we know this? Because at the end of the Cold War, how many nuclear weapons disappeared right at the end of the Cold War? Answer, zero. All still there. What happened? The story changed. The story changed. We no longer regarded those things as meaning an imminent threat. Why did that story change? Part of why that story changed, I discovered as I went through more of the history of this, is because the original Cold War story about why the Russians are a threat, if you think about it, right? The notion of the Soviet threat, we all grew up with this, right? Soviet threat, communists under the bed, right? All of this stuff. Why are the Soviets such a threat, especially right after World War II? Right? Run your historical clock back for a second, right? Right after World War II. What's happening, right? The United States has 50% of the productive capacity on the planet. No exaggeration. It's making half of everything that's made on the planet. Right? Its economy is enormous. It has the largest, most efficient military force ever assembled by anybody. Right? Depending on how you count raw numbers versus sort of technological capabilities. Oh, and yeah, it also has the only nuclear arsenal on the planet and is the only country to ever actually use them in combat. Soviet Union, not actually a threat to the United States in 1945. Or 1946, or 1947, or 1948, or 1949. It doesn't really become a threat until a small thing that happens in 1957, where the Soviets are able to send the rocket up, and if they can send it up, then maybe they can send it back down again. The Cold War is already in full steam by then. Something other than physical stuff has changed. What has changed? One of the things that you discover if you go back and look at the documents is that the reason this changes is because after the war, the story about the Soviets changes from these are people we can cooperate with to these are fundamentally non-Western societies that we have to defend ourselves against. And oh, by the way, there are these other Westerners in this place called Europe, and we need to defend them. So let's give them lots of money and call it the Marshall Plan, and then we're going to bring them into an alliance and call it NATO. That's a slightly oversimplified version of what happened, but that is basically the outline of what it is. The Cold War is a story. It's a narrative structure. It's about meaning. And in particular, and the thing I end up focusing on in the book, is that this constructivist story helps us make sense out of post-war German reconstruction. Because if you think about it, how weird is it that the United States spends billions of dollars to defeat the Germans and then spends billions more dollars building them right back up again? Right? And in some cases, building them up in such a way where we have to dismantle all your industrial capacity, but what we're really going to do is we're going to knock down your old, antiquated industrial capacity and let you come over to our factories here in the U.S., copy our really contemporary production techniques, and go back. We're going to help you. We're going to make you better than you were before. Oh, yeah, we just fought a huge war against you and killed lots of your people, but, you know, really, you're our friends now. That's really strange. There's something kind of odd about how fast that transition happens. And it turns out, again, this has a lot to do with the kind of legitimating story that gets told by politicians, and that story turns out to have an awful lot to do with the West, which is the subtitle of the book. So, since I've already hinted at some of the empirics, let me give you part of the second story, which is the empirical story, which is that post-war Reconstruction, both in Germany and just in general throughout Western Europe, is critically tied up with this notion of the West. To put it really simply, the Marshall Plan is about protecting the economics of Western civilization. The United States realized that if it didn't have partners that were going to be cooperating with it in sets of Western institutions, then we weren't going to have them anymore, so we needed to give them money to jumpstart things. And we could do that because fundamentally there was this story that said they're like us. They really are. They're Westerners like us. So it's not like we're going to be giving money to, you know, crazy people or something. We're going to be giving money to people like us, basic Westerners. They have our values. You know, we can cooperate with them, no problem. You end up with this notion of Western civilization playing some really interesting roles in post-war politics. One of them is there is this long-standing dominant narrative in the United States, which you might think of as exceptionalism. We know this one now because it's making a comeback on the pop charts, if you've seen it. It's the narrative that says, we, the United States, usually there's a little pause here. The pause is usually beloved of God because God wrote the Constitution for us. That's not always expressly said, but it's usually implied. The idea is that the United States is unique among countries, can do whatever it wants to do, and doesn't need to consult anybody else in order to do it. In polite circles, this gets turned into coalitions of the willing, and the kind of multilateralism, which means we tell you what we want you to do, and you cooperate with us if you want to. And if you don't, then we're just going to run right past you. This is not new. This is not something that they invented in the last 5 years. This is the traditional narrative of American foreign policy going back to before there was a United States. This is the sort of thing that informs George Washington's farewell address. This is the sort of thing that informs the foreign policies that are put forth in the Federalist Papers. Yes, there are foreign policies in the Federalist Papers. All the way back, this is the dominant approach to thinking about the United States. And you can see it in terms of what happens right after the U.S. fights major wars. They go out, they fight a war, they deploy lots of troops, and then what do? They win and they come home. That's what they did in World War I. Okay, we're here. Psych. Let's leave. World War II. Okay, VE Day. Yes! And see ya. 6 months later, 2/3 of the U.S. military has been demobilized. Right? Truman administration says, we got a problem here. We want to put troops back in Europe, but people think we're done. They think the United States has done its job, and we're going to come back and just protect ourselves at home. What are we going to do? How are we going to get them to believe that you actually need to go deploy troops in Europe again? He said, I know what we do. We make sure that we make it clear to them that this is a threat to all of Western civilization. And if we say that, then they'll get on our side. And they mounted a huge campaign about it, and poof, there you go. Right? Fights exceptionalism in the United States. It opposes a parallel kind of thing that was going on in Germany at the time. It's called a Sonderweg, which is the idea, sort of traditional German identity notion, that Germany constituted a special country. Most countries have this. Right? It's not to say exceptionalism or Sonderweg. I'm singling these two out because I'm sort of focusing on these two countries. But almost every country you can think of has that special narrative that says that they are divinely gifted among others. You know, in France you've got the certain idea of France, and you've got the whole noble Britain, and so on and so forth. Most countries have this kind of deliverance narrative. The notion of Western civilization is able to fight that, though, because they can say, no, you're not exceptional. You're one of a club. You're one of a group. You're part of a larger whole, something else that you are kind of submerged in. And therefore, policies that would tend to say, no, let's neutralize Germany so that it can be reunified, which the United States, of course, was not happy about because a neutral Germany could be easily overrun by Soviet tanks, said, maybe we don't want to do that. Turns out there's a group of Germans who, like the group of Americans who was in favor of Western civilization, said, hey, you know, we want to be part of the West. And it just so happens that one of the people who says this is this gentleman named Konrad Adenauer, who turns out to be the Chancellor of Germany in the immediate post-war period. Interesting, you go to Adenauer's house, which you see in his reception area at his house. He actually has some pictures hanging up on the wall. One of the pictures that he has a map of the Carolingian Empire. If you remember the Carolingian Empire, none of you remember the Carolingian Empire, because we all went around then. But if you know anything about the Carolingian Empire, this is Charlemagne. This was the empire that controlled most of what we now think of as France and Britain. And he had this up because he'd always have European dignitaries come through, and they say, Germany didn't used to just be Germany. It was part of something bigger. And, of course, then when the Americans would show up, they would have that picture, but then next to it they would have another picture, right? And the other picture that they would have was one of the original Waldseemüller maps of the discovery of America, drawn by a German cartographer, which kind of showed the connections
right?
Look, these are all together. We all belong together. That's the story. And so you have a power, government in power in Germany, and government in power in the United States, both acting on the presupposition that they constitute a larger whole. Hey, policies follow right from that. You end up with something very different. Imagine how the post-war world would look if you didn't have that story. If you didn't have a story that could legitimate that kind of connection. There's also, I mean, it's not just, post-war world is not just about America and Germany. There's this other country floating around, too. There's this one country called France. You might have heard of them. They lost some big game recently because their head gentleman made some mistakes. But anyway, the French were not altogether too pleased about the idea that Germany could be built back up again. They said, we don't want this, because every time you build the Germans up, they invade us. We don't like this very much. We really think they should be kept down. We kind of like that old Morgenthau plan you came up with back in 1943. That was the one where you were going to fill in all the Tsar coal mines and salt the fields and basically bomb the Germans back out of the Stone Age, like even earlier, back to the agrarian period. That way they're not going to be a threat. We like this plan. The Americans said, we're really not all that happy about that. So how did they sell this? Well, they sell this as, well, look, the Germans are Westerners like you. And all the Westerners have to band together against those others who we all agree are not Western, right? Those crazy Cossacks out there, right? Those people who are going to come over, those barbarian hordes are going to come over and, like, destroy everything. Them are those are people we have to fight against. The French, you can sort of imagine them going, oh, all right, fine, I'll cooperate with the Germans. And slowly the kind of opposition to German rearmament starts to fade away. So just in general, what this does is it makes this whole transatlantic cooperative order that we all get very used to after growing up in it, makes it all possible, this idea of Western civilization. Now, where did this come from? It's such a weird notion, as I said. Well, the short story about where it came from, ironically, is that there are a bunch of 19th century Germans. Yeah, think about the irony of this for a second. The United States defeats Germany in a war and then goes to reconstruct Germany, and what does it use? Ideas that came from Germany. And in particular, this idea of Western civilization. This was created by German academics who were trying to look for a way to do two things. First, to try to definitively prove that they belonged in sort of the Western part of Europe and the Russians didn't. So they said, oh, okay, so the West, which is us, versus the not West, which is those people. And the irony actually goes a little bit deeper, because you know where they got that story from? The Russians. Except they just inverted the terms of it and said, no, we're the Westerners. You people are crazy, right? We're West over here. So you have this 19th century foment going on where this idea shows up. And then in the time of the First World War, you end up with this rather interesting opposition that the German intellectuals come up with between Kultur and Civilisation. You can even hear it in the word, right? Civilisation, what is that? That is a transcription of a French word. And of course, talking about Germany in the early part of the 20th century, French equals bad. So Germans have Kultur, you know, real groundedness in the actual values of the real culture. And then the French, they just have civilisation, all that like courtly crap. You know, that's that. We're the real Westerners, basically. It's sort of what the First World War kind of becomes about. So you have this kind of argument going on, this floating around intellectual circles. How does it get out of intellectual circles? How did it get over to the U.S.? Well, fascinatingly enough, anybody ever heard of Oswald Spengler? See, if I'd asked that 50 years ago, every single one of you would have been like, oh yeah, Spengler, sure. How about Toynbee, Arnold Toynbee? Okay, so some of you heard of Toynbee. Toynbee is probably the more popular one in the United States, but Spengler is in some ways was the real wedge of this. Both of these guys wrote extremely long books, and by long, I mean Toynbee wrote this book called The Study of History. It's 12 volumes. You know, long book. There's an abridged version, which is only 2 volumes, or 2.5 volumes. This is, again, it's a civilizational history about the rise and fall of great civilizations. And Toynbee is debating with this guy, Oswald Spengler, who wrote this book called The Decline of the West. Note again, the West shows up when it's in decline, which was this impossible-to-read book, which is written in ridiculous, I mean, even dense by German standards, dense prose, which sold like hundreds of thousands of copies. For some insane reason that people are still trying to figure out. It was, if you look at the histories of the publishing industry, it was the first global blockbuster. I mean, it certainly didn't sell as much as things like the Bible, the Quran, which obviously sold more, but the first like global media phenomenon was Spengler. Everybody was reading Spengler. And this was the sort of thing that all these people were immersed in. All of these sorts of folks who then would later grow up to become the post-war planners and the administrators of the post-war world. They're reading this stuff about the West and Western values. So of course they have to reconstruct the world. What are they going to use? Well, the stuff we were reading, the West and Western values. And where did they read this stuff? You know where they read it? They read it in this course that they took in college. And it was called the Western Civ course. And if you went to college before the 1960s, you probably took this course. If you went to college after the 1960s, you probably didn't, because one of the issues in the campus revolts in the 1960s was about getting rid of the Western Civ course, because people noticed, not for the first time, but for one of the more prominent times, people noticed that if you look at the history of Western civilization, a lot of it is actually written by white European guys who are now dead. And so people said, no, we want to study more than just this. But up until this point, right, everybody took this Western Civ class, the Plato to NATO course. And one of the things that literally, the Plato to NATO course. And it turns out that that name is actually very revealing, because where that course came from originally was started during the First World War. It was funded by the War Department in 1917. And it was first started at Columbia University, where it was called the War Issues class. I actually taught it in its current form. It's now called Contemporary Civilization. But it was called the War Issues class, and the course had one point, which was teach these young kids why we're going to go send them to fight and die in the battlefields of France. So the professors got together, and they said, how are you going to... Hey, you know what? They're fighting and dying for the West! Western civilization, that's right, yeah, let's teach them all about that. So that's what people taught. After the war, they liked the course so much, they changed the name, they called it the Peace Issues course, and then they called it the Problems of Post-War Order course, and then they eventually settled on Contemporary Civilization. And when they did that, they wrote these two very large red source books called Contemporary Civilization source books, which were then adopted by like 250 colleges and universities in the United States. Everybody marched through this class in the 1920s, in the 1930s, in the 1940s. So when people are sitting around trying to figure out what to do with the post-war world, they've got a language at hand, a language they learned in college, and a language that all the other educated people in the country who they were actually speaking to also read. They said, oh, we could talk about the West. Yeah, oh, right, the West, right, we studied that. Okay, cool. There's a common language for people to speak. This also surprised the heck out of the Europeans, because then the Americans showed up and they started talking about Plato and Aristotle, and the Europeans were like, Americans have culture? When did they learn about like great antiquities and art and stuff? And these Americans are like, yeah, we know these things. We learned it in college. Oh, you know, we can cooperate with you people. This is good. Can we have some money? And of course the Americans said, well, you're Westerners. Okay, I guess you can have some money. And lo and behold, the Marshall Plan and NATO. So again, I'm making that a little bit faster. That actually takes many chapters in the book to get through, but that's the basic idea. Final story I want to tell you real quick is the moral story. What do you do with all of this stuff? Because one of the punchlines of the work that I have been doing, and I've been doing this not just on Western civilization, I do this on a variety of other kinds of things as well. You could do this kind of analysis of nations and national identity rhetorics. I actually have a course this summer called Identity in Practice, where we've been going to downtown D.C. and looking at how monuments and memorials help to construct a sense of identity. We're going to a baseball game in 2 weeks to look at how that constructs a sense of identity. If you've been to a major sporting event lately, you know that is all about constructing a sense of national identity, all the rituals at the beginning and all the various sort of breaks that show up in between with baseball games, all between innings and such. And in D.C. it's even more pronounced, because you don't get through a game without there being at least two salutes to the troops, which is a whole series of ways in which there's a narrative here being spun about who we are and what we stand for and what we're doing. Right? It's a great theater for these kinds of things. Or if you caught any of the World Cup, you know, people weren't out there going, you know, yay, random guys. No, it was, yay, our country, right? Reinforcing a certain sense of self. This is what we call, what I would call, a social construct. Now, I've got to be careful here. Social construct doesn't mean made up. It doesn't mean fake. It doesn't mean social construct as opposed to the not social construct. Because this is not what I mean. When I say Western civilization is a social construct, or that it's socially constructed, I mean it is contingent. It is contingent on human action. It would not be there if it were not for certain things that people say and do. It is not a product of, you know, the biochemistry of the planet that we have this thing called Western civilization. There are several intervening steps that involve people doing things that they could in fact have done differently. What this means is that if we want to have a policy that's placed on the grounds of something called Western civilization, we shouldn't delude ourselves into thinking we're somehow making a policy that's in accordance with the real way that the universe is actually set up. We're making a choice here. We are constructing a certain sense of who we are. We are, in fact, producing a certain way of being in the world. And therefore, we have to evaluate this much more pragmatically. We need to think more about the function of this story. So a couple just quick thoughts that I'll leave you with about the function of this story. Well, take the two words, Western and civilization. The word Western is fascinating because it implies, because if you can have Western civilization, then you can have other civilizations. Right? Western's an adjective. So if there can be one, there can be others. there's a certain kind of diversity built into the story of Western civilization. This is the West, but there's a not West, and other not West, so that there's some kind of pluralism built right into the story itself. Now, there is a danger, which is, I think, well exemplified by people like Samuel Huntington, of essentialism, the idea that we can then spend our time trying to figure out what the real, true essence of Western civilization is, and usually that comes with a little consequence, which is now that we know what it is and you don't, we are justified in kicking the heck out of you until you actually accept our version of what Western civilization is about. So there's a danger of essentialism, but I think this is a solvable danger. And it is a solvable danger. This is what I used to do when I taught contemporary civilization at Columbia, right? I'm teaching the war issues class, right? I'm teaching the class that's designed to give people this sense of Western identity. And the way I taught it was not, here is the Western truth. The way I taught it was, here are all of these people who are part of the Western canon, and they don't agree with each other. Plato and Aristotle actually don't agree with each other about a lot of things, like the status of women, for instance. Plato saying, yeah, women can be guardians, no problem. And Aristotle's like, no, women are naturally inferior. Okay, that's a big argument right there. We can have that debate. And then it's even funnier if you, because everybody points back at Plato and Aristotle. It's funny how much of us do that. We sort of refer to Plato and Aristotle and the Greek antecedents, like the Greek antecedents of democracy. Go back and actually read what the Greeks thought about democracy. It was not their favorite form of government. Right? Neither Plato nor Aristotle is particularly happy about democracy. And this idea that somehow our democracy is a direct continuity from Greece, No, that's a line. That's not actually the case. Instead of thinking about this as an essence of the West, why don't we think about this as a set of traditions? There's a set of conversations, arguments, debates that have been going on for millennia between these folks, between these people whose books we now have access to. When I used to teach this, I would teach it as, all right, let's put these guys into competition with each other. So, Hobbes, Locke, and Rousseau walk into a bar, and you ask them, and I actually had an exam question that started that way. And then the exam question right below it was, is Neo in The Matrix an example of Nietzsche's Superman or Kierkegaard's Knight of Faith or both? Discuss. Students were equally divided as to which of those two questions they thought was more interesting to answer. But think about this more in terms of a tradition, right? There are things about the Western philosophical tradition that are different than traditions that show up in other places and other times. Doesn't mean that there's a single identifiable essence of the West, but there's sort of a family resemblance, shall we say, right? It's a long family argument that's been going on over here. And I think that's important to recognize so we can sort of get away from essentialism that way. The other word, of course, is the word civilization. And the thing with the word... Oh, that's not me, is it? No, good. The other thing with the word civilization, right, is it allows there to be a certain amount of space for internal critique. Because if as soon as I say to you, I'm civilized, well, I better behave civilized. Because if I don't, then you go, wait a minute, you said you were civilized. You said you were civilized. What are you doing? Beating up on women and children. Wait, stop, don't do that. There's something about the standard, about the word itself, that allows this kind of internal critique. Right? It's a dangerous thing to claim that you're civilized. Because if you're not acting that way, people can call you out on it. So there's some certain, I think there's some room to maneuver within the story. And there's another wonderful thing about civilization I think is particularly useful for us to think about at this particular point in history. Since... And I'm not exaggerating here, right? The United States, at the moment, has the greatest agglomeration of economic and destructive capability that's ever been assembled in the history of the planet. Right? Think about that, right? The greatest ability to produce and destroy that has ever been put together in the history of the planet. And if that capability is being operated with a story that says, we don't have to listen to anybody else, because we have what it takes, we are doing everything the way it's supposed to be done, and we are, in a sense, infallible, that's a little scary. However, civilization, because it's bigger than an individual country, is an antidote to provincialism. Right? If we say, no, we know a few things, because we've been doing this for a while. We have some ideas, but you know what? Other people do too, and we should talk to them about this. Instead of this national provincialism that I think is easy for every nation to fall into, the notion of civilization can function as an antidote and say we shouldn't do everything just on our own, that we should in fact be cooperating with, we should be dialoguing with, we should be a little more, to use a word that got featured heavily in a presidential campaign a couple of years ago, certain humility to our foreign policy, and not this kind of national triumphalism that we often fall into, particularly at times when we perceive ourselves to be under threat. So those are a few stories about the West that I think are useful to toss out there. And I think they're useful to toss out there not necessarily because I think I'm right, which I do, but I'm happy to argue with you about that. Everything that I toss out, whether in the book or in this sort of a forum or in a class, is a debating point. And I like absolutely nothing more than for a student to come back at me and say, "You are full of crap." And then I can say to them, "Okay, reasons. Come on. Reasons. If you have reasons, if you have arguments, like nothing better than a good argument about these things. So let's dialogue. Thanks."